she explained in a quiet voice. Three of the boys are married, Wu Chao's father, and although I was not able to arrange perfect marriages with huge dowries, I did as well as could be expected. Mrs. Qing, as you would expect, argued very strongly against me, and at the last she even brought up an unpleasant fact. Your husband died of leprosy, she said. But I didn't lose my temper, for there was more important business at hand, and at last she gave in. Ah Chao has four children. Ao Chao has three, and Fei Chao three. I am going to try very hard to get Mrs. Qing's youngest daughter to marry O Chao, but I may have a good deal of trouble there, for the girl is a beauty and will be able to command a high price. At the house, things go well. Kimo and Apikela look after things for us all, and they are precious people. The fields yield as before, and pineapples continue to sell well. Ah Chao has a fine restaurant that is always busy, and Ao Chao has a good vegetable business. But the good news, Wu Chao's father, is that your son Fei Chao is already on a ship going to Michigan to study to be a lawyer. When I put him aboard the vessel, I could see you and Polani in our little house down there, dreaming of going around the world and seeing strange places. Think. Think. Our son, our own child, is going to be a scholar. In gratitude for this great boon, Nyuk Tsien fell silent, and tears trembled on her lids. And the sun rose higher in the heavens, and she stayed by the grave. At 11 she asked, Is it not hot on those rocks? You really ought to have a tree, Wu Chao's father. And in the later afternoon she left the grave and the meal she had set for the ghost. On her walk back toward Kalupapa, she passed the old graveyard and saw a new stone, larger than the others, and she wondered who of her friends lay buried there. So she waited until a Hawaiian leper came by with hardly any face, and she asked him, Who lies in that grave? And the man said, Father Damien. He died one of us. When she reached Kalupapa, she found that while she was talking with her husband, the settlement had discovered who she was, and she returned to see many people waiting for her. Pake Kokua, they called, and many came to greet her who had known her in the evil days. Some she recognized, for the disease had been kind to them, but others no eyes but God's could see as human beings. Pake Kokua, they all cried, it's good to have you back. She sat down on a rock, a little Chinese woman with a sunburned face, and they gathered around. A priest came up and asked in Hawaiian, Are you the one they call the Pake Kokua? She said that she was, and he said, You are remembered in this place. She asked if it was true that Father Damien had died of leprosy, and the priest said, Only last spring. Did he suffer? Nyuk Tsien asked. And the priest replied, Here everyone suffers. She said, Kalupapa is better than Kalawao used to be. And the young man said, When the people in Honolulu wakened to their responsibility, it had to become better. She asked, Have you found any drug that cures? And he replied, The infinite mercy of God has not yet shown us the way, but he will not permit a thing like leprosy to continue without a cure. Meanwhile, we pray. In late 1889, Nyuk Tsien spent most of her spare time arguing with the Qing family about terms on which their youngest daughter, Qing Xiu Han, might be given to her youngest son, Australia. She told Mrs. Qing frankly, The boy is very good at school, and I don't worry about him in that regard. But having grown up with Hawaiians, he is more like them than a Chinese. He's got to marry a Chinese girl, otherwise he will be lost to us. Mrs. Qing pointed out, You allowed Ao Chao and Mei Chao to marry Hawaiian girls. Nyuk Tsien argued, Those girls brought much land with them, and the marriages were good for the boys. But O Chao's problem is different. He doesn't require land. He requires a strong-minded Chinese wife. But her antagonist felt that Xu Han, being rather prettier than average, ought to be saved for a better prospect than Australia. At this time, Xu Han, who was now a sparkling Chinese girl of 15, had begun to show her headstrong nature and had broken away from the severe old Chinese custom which required girls to hide at home. While her sister, Africa's wife, tended her three babies, Xu Han liked to walk up and down Hotel Street, and because she was unusually attractive, this caused much comment in the Chinese community. On one such trip, she met Nguyễn Tsin, who said to her, "Have you ever seen my son Australia?" "No," the girl said. "He's in his brother's restaurant. Let's have a bowl of noodles together." So Nguyễn Tsin and the pretty young girl went into Asia's place and sat down. And in a moment Australia appeared and was astonished to see them, for Wu Chao's auntie had never before entered the place. He sat down with them, and Nguyễn Tsin asked bluntly, "Don't you think your brother's wife's sister is attractive?" Obviously, Australia did. And after a few minutes, Nguyễn Tsin found occasion to leave the table and talk with her son Asia, who said, "It's disgraceful to bring a girl like that in here." In the weeks that followed, Nguyễn Tsin often asked Australia, "Why don't you help your brother at the restaurant?" And whenever her only unmarried son did so, Nguyễn Tsin managed to find Xu Han somewhere in Chinatown, and she would bring the two together. So that before the year was out, it was not Wu Chao's auntie who was arguing with the wealthy Qings that they permit their only remaining daughter to marry Australia. It was the daughter herself who did all the talking. "My rascal girl," Mrs. Qing called her. Nguyễn Tsin prudently dropped out of the picture, and in early 1890, a marriage was announced. At the wedding, Nguyễn Tsin, then 43 years old, but looking closer to 60, sat silent and thanked the Hakka gods that they had been so good to her. Then her attention was attracted to a Hakka woman who had brought as a gift a small sandalwood box, carried from Canton. And as Nguyễn Tsin smelled that aromatic present, she thought, "This is indeed the fragrant tree country." By the time the last decade of the 19th century opened, Wild Whip Hawksworth was concentrating his considerable energy on two projects, women and making Hawaii part of the United States. For a while, his performance in the former field was the more spectacular, for after his divorce from the Spanish woman Aloma Duarte, he spent his free time with a strange assortment of creatures who could be counted upon to drift ashore from passing ships. They were women without faces, but with memorable bodies, and it was uncanny how, as soon as they touched shore, they made a direct line to Wild Whip, as if he had the capacity to send out messages that he could be found lolling on the porch of the Hawaiian Hotel. Quickly, these drifting women moved their luggage—they never had much—into the rooms Whip occupied, and after a while each moved along to Manila or Hong Kong. Many would have enjoyed staying, but Whip was too smart to allow that. From time to time he spent his weekends in Rat Alley, across the river in Iwilei, and one of the most common sights at the Hawaiian Hotel, built by the king for the entertainment of important guests, was the deferential appearance of some Chinese brothel keeper with news for Whip that a new girl had come in, or that an old one wished particularly to see him. It was understandable that women liked Whip, for at 33 he was tall and lean, with knife scars across his left cheek and black hair that rumpled in the wind. He had flashing white teeth and slow, penetrating eyes. He was careful of his appearance, and when he rode horseback along the dusty roads of his sugar plantations, he could speak to his hands in masterful pidgin, with appropriate touches of Chinese, Japanese, Hawaiian, or Portuguese, to fit the individual workman with whom he talked. But for all sentences, regardless of language, he adopted the lilting accent brought to the islands by Mexican cowboys, so that each statement ended with an upward song. Hey, you Joe, what you think? You holo holo water? The words think and water were heavily accented and given an ingratiating melody. While his men were in the fields tending the cane, Wild Whip often stopped by their homes to talk with their women, and it naturally happened that occasionally these women would appreciate his courtly manners, and he found great pleasure in suddenly leaping into bed with them and having a wild few minutes, after which he called as he rode off, "Hey, you rosy knee, take care you boy he come home. He one fine man, I think." Twice he had been slashed at with machetes, and when he reflected upon that occupational hazard, he supposed that some day he would die in a scene of wild brutality, and the sanctimonious newspapers of the islands would scream the scandal. And at the prospect he laughed, thinking, "What a great way to die!" Then, in late 1892, Wild Whip became galvanized into even wilder action in a completely different arena, for the United States was beginning to show signs of once more discriminating against the importation of Hawaiian sugar. The great planters of cane in Louisiana were determined to end the reciprocity arrangements, whereby Hawaii sent sugar to the mainland tax-free, while the United States was allowed to send certain goods into Hawaii, and also to use Pearl Harbor as a naval base. Cried the Louisiana sugar men, "We don't need their sugar, and we don't need Pearl Harbor." For 30 years, the New Orleans sugar tycoons had been waging war against Hawaii, and they had managed to hold the profits of Hawaiian planters like Wild Whip Hawksworth to reasonable limits, but they had failed to kill off the industry. Now a new factor had entered the battle against Hawaii. The huge western states of Colorado and Nebraska were beginning to grow beets and to grind them into sugar, and they too wanted to destroy Hawaiian competition. Within a few years, it was likely that a coalition of Louisiana, Alabama, Mississippi, Colorado, and Nebraska, plus such new states as Wyoming and Utah, would form to drive Hawaiian sugar forever out of the market, and when this happened, sugar planters like Wild Whip would see their massive fortunes begin to vanish. "In sugar, there's only one rule," Whip told the sugar planters he had assembled. "Either we sell to the United States or we don't sell. Our sole aim must be to protect that market." "We're losing it," John Janders pointed out. "Right now, I represent 11 of your major sugar plantations, and with the way those bastards from Louisiana and Colorado are trying to strangle us, I can see 9 of your 11 outfits going into bankruptcy. One more serious cut in our American market, and I don't know what we'll do." "Excuse me, John," Whip interrupted. "You're right in what you say, but I'm afraid you're mincing words. I happen to have the figures, and by God, nobody can listen to these without panic. Since the McKinley tariff, every damn sugar man in Louisiana and Colorado has been getting a subsidy of 2 cents a pound, whereas sugar imported from Hawaii has been penalized. What's it all mean? During the first 12 months of this McKinley abortion, our profits have dropped $5 million. I don't mean the profits of Hawaii. I mean the profits of the 9 men sitting in this room. Now, as to the actual invested value of our plantations, they've lost $12 million, and it's going to get worse and worse." He paused to allow discussion of the peril in which the Hawaiian sugarmen found themselves, for up to the moment of this meeting, the great planters had known they were in danger, but no one had had the courage to accumulate the depressing figures. Now, under Whip's lashing, they had to face facts. Companies were going to go bankrupt, and men were going to lose plantations their fathers had built. "What do you think we should do?" John Janders asked. He was a year older than Whip, and 8 centuries more conservative. Whip parried the question and observed, "Obviously, John, unless we do something, we're going to lose Hawaii. It's going to subside into the barren, useless batch of islands it was in 1840. There was a hush, and Whip continued. Those aren't just words, either. Two more bad years, John, and you'll be bankrupt. Absolutely pow. Dave Hale may be able to hold out a little longer, but Harry Hewlett can't. Then he thumped himself in the chest and added, I'm good for 18 months, and then I'm bankrupt. Gentlemen, I don't propose to go bankrupt. It was a sober group of Hales, Hewletts, and Janderses who listened to these gloomy but accurate words. Finally, Dave Hale asked, How are you going to escape, Whip? With carefully studied words, Whip replied, I've asked that the doors be closed, gentlemen, because what you and I are about to do is ugly work. So if any of you have weak kidneys, I'll give you time to go out and take a piss right now, and don't bother to come back. He waited in silence, and could see that the sugar men were breathing hard. I'll give you 2 more minutes, he said, and after that there's no turning back. He put his watch on the table, and when the seconds had passed, he said simply, Gentlemen, we are now duly constituted as the Committee of Nine, and no one here must have any illusions. This afternoon, I want you quietly to buy up all the available guns in Honolulu. He put his left hand to his chin, and with his thumb rubbed the scar that crossed his face like jagged lightning. When the shock of his first command had been absorbed, he added, Yes, we're going to launch a revolution, win control of these islands, and turn them over to the United States. Once we've done that, Louisiana and Colorado can go to hell. They'll be powerless to destroy us. Do you think the United States will accept us? Dave Hale asked timorously. Wild Whip dropped both hands on the table and said harshly, Gentlemen, the days ahead are going to be damned difficult, but there is one thing we must never doubt. The United States is going to accept Hawaii. He thundered his fists on the table and repeated, We are going to be part of America. How? Dave Hale began. I don't know how, Whip interrupted. But we're going to join America, and we're going to make all the goddamn money growing sugar that we want to. John Janders spoke quickly. Whip, you know I'm even stronger for sugar than you are, because I've got more to lose. But take my advice on one thing. Don't organize this revolution around sugar. Among ourselves, here in the committee, all right. But don't let the outside world know. For them, you've got to have an idea bigger than sugar. Young Hale added, John's right. The big American newspapers will never support us if our revolution is built on sugar. One of the Hewlett boys, who owned the biggest sugar plantation of all, suggested, Somehow we've got to work in the word democracy. Red-blooded Americans on these islands are sick of living under a corrupt monarchy. That's it, John Janders cried. Something the American Congress can get hold of. American citizens yearning to be free. Wild Whip smiled at his associates. You fellows have a lot of sense. I agree with you that if we stand forth as a sugar revolution, the bastards in Louisiana and Colorado would crucify us. I can hear them now, bleeding for the monarchy. But I have a better idea, gentlemen. You and I are going to start this revolution, and we're going to direct it, and when everyone else gets scared, we're going to fire the guns. But, and he paused for effect, not one of us is going to appear before the public. Who will? Dave Hale asked. We'll get the lawyers who handle our plantation affairs, and the newspaper people, and some school teachers, and a couple of ministers, Whip snapped. This is going to be the most respectable revolution in history. You're going to hear more high-flown sentiments than you thought existed, because I've decided on the ideal man to stand before the public. Who are you thinking of? Hale probed. Whip looked directly at the young man and said, Your Uncle Micah. David Hale gasped and said, He'll never revolt against the monarchy. He's a citizen of Hawaii and takes it very seriously. We're all citizens of Hawaii, Whip replied, and we all take it seriously. That's why we're going to save these islands. But Uncle Micah's been an advisor to the crown, a personal friend of all the kings. He's an ordained minister. For those very reasons, we've got to have him, Whip interrupted. He won't support us willingly. He'll preach against us, and he'll despise our revolution. But the force of circumstance will make him our leader. Believe me, it'll be Uncle Micah Hale with his long white beard who will send the final letter to President Harrison. Hawaii is yours. At this point, John Janders threw some very cold water upon the revolution. I got a letter from Washington which said that everyone there thinks Grover Cleveland will be elected again this year. At the mention of this portly, strong-willed Democrat, the Committee of Nine grew glum, for in his previous administration, Cleveland had delivered several staggering blows against Hawaiian Sugar, and it was likely that he would do so again. But more important, the idealistic reformer had come out strongly against the spirit of manifest destiny then popular in America. The United States wants no empire, Cleveland had proclaimed. And it was the shadow of this great bulk that fell across the incipient revolution. But not even Grover Cleveland frightened Wild Whip Hawksworth. To hell with his mealy-mouthed nonsense about international morality. We'll start the revolution right away. Wind it up fast, and have Uncle Micah throw the islands to Harrison before the next election is held. By the time Cleveland's president, we'll be part of America. Can we do it in the time available? One of the Hewlett boys asked. If we work, Whip replied. The Committee of Nine broke up their first meeting, and each man took upon himself three jobs. Buy all available guns. Find respectable citizens to stand before the public as front men of the revolution, and test every friend to see who could be depended upon to help overthrow the Hawaiian monarchy. When the frightened but determined sugar planters were gone, Whip Hawksworth was left with the most difficult job of all. He had to find some way of making white-bearded, righteous old Micah Hale assume leadership of the revolt. It was not a strong monarchy to begin with. In 1872, the great Kamehameha line had ended in sickness and frustration, to be followed by a succession of amiable but incompetent alii. One had sought to revive paganism as the consolidating force of Hawaiian life. Another had tried to abrogate the Constitution and take Hawaii back to an absolute monarchy, unrestrained by any middle-class legislature. There had been palace revolutions, the election of kings according to their personal popularity, and a shocking scandal in which one king was caught trying to peddle an opium consumption.